Okay, Boker Tov, good morning everybody. I like this more, what I would call intimate setting. It's really a different room. Hopefully we'll get the same effect of what we're learning, which I hope till now hasn't been too, soul-destroying, I think is probably the word I'm thinking of, but I'm not here to destroy, so I'm here to, in life, we go through life with certain illusions. And part of growing up is when your illusions actually get tested and sometimes even get changed or even in extreme cases even get shattered. Shattered illusions, right? You always thought that when you learned Megillas Esther, you always thought it was a nice, cozy event. Not a nice event, but a cozy event within this kind of very cocoon situation that is the way it's presented. And I think so far, I hope it's become very clear to you that this is not quite the way it is. I saw on... I'm not going to recommend it, because again, it was pretty gruesome. There is a follow-up movie on Netflix. It's called The Rise of the Three... Oh, no, The 300 Rise of the Empire. And that movie is exactly what we are learning at the moment. It's just amazing. They actually... It's called Rise of the Empire. Rise of the Empire. And what it's about is essentially the two battles, the Battle of Marathon that we spoke about, 490, and then 10 years later, the Battle of Salamis. And what the film actually points out, interestingly, and I'm always prepared to learn from any source where you can learn from, the film points out that it got to the point where Xerxes, Ahasuerus, declared himself to be a god. And you know something? That really is going to tie in a little bit what we're going to say today. Chapter 1 of the Megillah. We started learning it last week. We started looking at it. We've now placed the historical significance of Chapter 1. We've said that essentially what's going on is Ahasuerus, Xerxes is trying to build his army. He has these two parties. Party number one, where he has all the diplomats coming from all over the world to the 127 countries, and they come to Shushan. And then party number two, the 7 days. We saw all that, and we said that, and in fact, the Gemara brings this, Rav Shimon bar Yochai. The Gemara says the name of Rav Shimon bar Yochai is Talmidim. The students of Shimon bar Yochai asked the Rebbe, he says, why did the Jews deserve to be punished, to die in the story of Purim? And he says, because they went and nehenu misudat Ahasuerus. They had pleasure, they had benefit from the meal of Ahasuerus. And that's what we were saying. The second meal, everybody turned up. No tickets required, just bring a bottle and everything was fine. And that's what they did. So the reality of it is so interesting is that the first chapter of the Megillah, which everybody asked the question, Lama, why do we have all this introduction? You know, the story of Megillah really is about Mordechai, Esther, Haman. What do we need to know about the parties and everything going on in Shushan? And we've said, certainly according to the way we've learned it so far, according to Rav Lau, we've said that the essence is to teach us really from a historical perspective what we're dealing with. We're dealing with an Ahasuerus, a guy called Xerxes, who's really crazy. He declares himself a god. He makes himself out as if he's infallible. And part of his infallibility is to become the ruler of the whole world, even to the point where he's looking to expand the empire. Instead of 127 countries, what is the United Nations today? I don't know, what is it, up to 180, right? He'll make it go to 100, whatever it was in those days. I mean, it's just beyond belief. So that's what we've seen so far. What I want to do today is take a slightly different look at chapter 1 and go a bit into chapter 2 and look at the Malbim. And for those who don't know who the Malbim is or have come across it but not really familiar with it, the Malbim is a phenomenon. Malbim Remeah, his family name is an acrostic of his Hebrew name. Mem Lamed Bet Mem. Meah Leibish Ben Mechel, I think it was. I think that was the family name, if I'm not mistaken. Known as Malbim. He was chief rabbi of Bucharest in the 1850s. He was around, very outspoken against the reform movement, really got himself into big trouble, was arrested a number of times by the government because the people went to the government and said, this rabbi's out of control, he's criticizing his fellow Jews, and they arrested him. He was released pretty soon, but he eventually had 15 jobs. Imagine, 15 rabbinic positions. It doesn't bear thinking about. For those of us in the profession, to have one or two is really, you know, maybe that's as much as we can contemplate. 15 would, I think, be crazy. But that's what he did. 15 positions. And in between all of that, he wrote this phenomenal commentary, not just on Torah, but he wrote it on the whole of Tanakh. And it came out, and it was boycotted. The greatest thing that can happen to a book when it comes out is you get the notice from the rabbis, the so-called, you know, what I call the gedolim, with speech marks around the word, who come along and say, this book is forbidden, right? And apparently when the Malbim produced his book, everybody said, look at what he wrote on Sefer Daniel, one line in Sefer Daniel. Who's going to learn Sefer Daniel anyway? I mean, hopefully we all will. But you know what I'm saying? There was one line there, and he talks about when Mashiach is coming. And he puts a date on it. And it's interesting because the date is in the 1920s. He actually predicted 1928, 29. Very interesting time when things were really beginning to happen in Eretz Yisrael at that time. But it wasn't Mashiach's sign. It wasn't the time yet. But because he put a date on Mashiach, on the date in the book, people said, oh, you can't buy this sefer. So for one line of the book, they ignored the other 20 volumes. And it was crazy. Eventually people understood, look at what he wrote. This man was not only proficient in Torah and Torah studies, but he was very proficient in Hebrew. And when he finds a book where he's looking at the nuances of the text, and to give you one example, what he does in the parsha in a few weeks' time with the butler and the baker, he looks at the nuances of that story, Yosef in jail, and he works out there's not three people in jail, there's five people in jail. Right? And you look at the Malbim there, you'll be amazed. The whole story that you thought you knew, these people were in jail, and Yosef, and the whole thing, the Malbim says, no, you don't really know what the story is doing. It's actually five people in jail. Incredible. Beyond belief. And he does this all the time. Malbim is a revelation. I argue very strongly when I teach Malbim that he wasn't closed in the yeshiva. He was clearly a learned man. But there's no question in my mind that he must have had very good libraries where he lived. Because he brings in so much secular knowledge. He talks about festivals of Egypt, one of his commentaries in Sefer Melachim, and he talks about a line of government, which he does over here in Megillat Esther. This is a guy who really, you know, when I teach Malbim, I always ask the students, where would he be teaching today? 100 years later, right? Where would he be a professor today? And it's not in Lakewood. I'm absolutely convinced. I don't think Lakewood can handle it. I think he'd probably be teaching either in Shea University, maybe even giving lectures in JTS occasionally as well. Not because he's conservative, he's totally committed Orthodox rabbi, but he is got that. He has that broad vision, the academic vision, like we're trying to do here. Look at things from a historical perspective, as well as from what we call traditional midrashic or whatever perspective, rabbinic perspective. And I don't know, maybe we'll be teaching in Harvard. I'm really not sure. Who knows? You know, the divinity school in Harvard. It may be. Who knows? It's a speculation. The Malbim on the first chapter of Megillat Esther. This is the page that I gave out. And I apologize, I didn't get a chance to staple. I just made the copies yesterday. But I didn't get a chance to staple. What I found online, amazing what you find online these days, is the, and I've cut it down because it's much longer than this, is his introduction on page 1, going through page 2, page 1 in Hebrew, page 2 in English. So what I'm going to do is read a little bit of the Hebrew, but if you're not following the Hebrew, just read through the English on page 2, because it's a word-for-word translation. I don't know who's done the translation, I have no clue, but I'm very grateful. To sit and do these long translations are really difficult. There's a wonderful project at the moment going on in Israel, in America, called Sefaria, sefaria.org. It's a fantastic organization. They are taking all of these texts, that traditional texts, and not only reproducing them in this kind of square print, because many of them are not in readable print at any time, but also adding many translations to the text. This is a resource, again, which I encourage for my students at college to use Faria. It's a phenomenon. Absolutely incredible.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Just before you start that, could you tell us again the name of that, how spelled by word, the
Sefaria? S for sugar, E, F for Freddy, A, R for Rabbi, I, A. Sefaria.org. They have the most wonderful website. It is organized by subject. So you'll have section on Tanakh, section on Midrash, section on Halakha, Jewish law, and it's all set out so beautifully. And as you see, when you go on there, the number of books that they are now bringing to the public forum is incredible. Incredible. IA.org. And it's fabulous. That's that. If that's what you get out of this year, it's worth coming just for that. I'm telling you, because it's phenomenal. There is a project which is happening at the moment. They actually advertised recently for someone in New York. I think they're looking for someone to do more marketing to get the word out there, because a lot of people never heard of it. And it is really extraordinary. So here we have, for instance, Malbim. I could have brought you the original Hebrew one, which is in Rashi print and is a bit here and a paragraph here, but it was very unuser-friendly. This is phenomenal. So what I'm going to do, just read a little bit of the Malbim, page 1, and then I'm going to go to page, the end, the last paragraph on page 4, where he gives you the basic conclusion of why this chapter 1 is there. Now he's also bothered. In the same way as Rav Lau was bothered from a historical perspective, the Malbim is also very, very bothered by the fact that this whole chapter is dedicated to events which don't seem to connect directly, at least, with the Megillah story. It's Achashverosh, we know, and it's Vashti, and big deal. So that was the whole story in Persia, and we know that the whole Purim story is 9 years later. It's not happening immediately. Chapter 2, remember last week we said, was 7 years after Achashverosh becomes the king. So the whole events of Purim and how they develop and the attack on the Jews, etc., is many years later. So why do we need to know what's going on in chapter 1? So listen to this, it's phenomenal. I'm going to read in the Hebrew, and as I said, on page 2, you want to follow it in the English, Rakasha, it's also there. So it goes like this. Levaera Pasha Azot. I want to explain what's going on in chapter 1. I've got to give you one introduction. The problem is, it's about 10 pages long. Fine. He says, Hine, Hamlachat HaMelech b'yamim HaKadmonim b'memsholot HaMitzrayim HaKazdiyim HaParsiyim HaModayim. Who knew about this? When you had kings in the old world, the world of Egypt, in the ancient world, the Chaldees, the Persians, the Medians, go and figure. He says, "Hayta lacha mishtei drachim." You had a king, or appointing a king. It was done in one of two ways. Okay, so here's a lesson in political science of the ancient world. Line 3. Aleph. The first way is hamolech alidei bechirat ha'am. You had elections like we do around the world. She'eskimo alish echad namnicho aleihem. They chose a king by voting. That's way number one. Bet. Fourth line. Hamolech biyad chazaka. You had a guy who came in, a shtarka, and he had the army with him. Shekavash medina umalach aleihem bar kocham. He took over against their will. Kudita, he came in and he started ruling. Hamosha, Katuba, Nimrod. Just reading about Nimrod, the last couple of parashiyot. The guy was a shtarka. He came on and took on the world. Umizeh omdu az shnei minei mamlachot. So from these two types of kingships, one which was voted by the people, and one which was enforced on the people, you got two types of mamlacha, two types of kingdoms. What types? Aleph, mamlechet mugbele, a limited kingship, v'hu shem misharet ha-melech ala'am, the king is bound to the people, all right? And if you go down two lines, bet, Mamleche bilti mugbele, an unlimited kingship. Basically, what he's saying is that if the king is appointed by the people, he's limited to the voice of the people. Even the president of the United States has his finger on the button to destroy, God forbid, the whole world, but he's limited by the people. He can be here today and he's voted out next year, whenever it's going to be, right? He's voted out very soon. The reality of it is, when you have a kingship which is not from the people, it's built in Mugbele. It's unlimited. The king can do literally whatever he wants. And we saw this in Germany in 1933. Using democracy, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, became essentially not just the king, he became a megalomaniac. He was literally running, wanted to control the whole world. I mean, this is how dangerous it gets. What the Malbim points out is that Achashverosh, Xerxes, when he started his whole kingship, was limited in terms of his kingship for a number of reasons. He says one of the things that is very, very interesting, and again, I'm going to point it out to you on the Malbim's commentary. I'm not going to go through this whole thing of political science because it's worth reading, and you've got it here in the English. If you go to that large paragraph halfway down, when it stops going Aleph Beit Gimel Dalet Hay, right at the very hard to. I should have put numbers on these pages. If you're halfway down, there's a line which begins with a hey. Hamolech mamlecha mugbelen. Right? When you have a limited kingship. He goes through a whole bunch of definitions of the difference between a kingship which is limited and a kingship which is unlimited. And he says, for instance, Hamolech mamlecha mugbelen. He says one of the things in chapter 1 which we don't realize is Ahasuerus is moving the whole capital of Persia. He's moving it to Shushan. The Malbim claims that before Xerxes, the capital of Persia was not Shushan. And in a way, we've probably said this, it was in Babylon, and then the Persians took over the Babylonian. So his argument is that by stressing the whole thing happening in Shushan, it's Ahasuerus trying to gain unlimited control. If you come along as a president of the United States, and you say, no more Washington, or whatever expression he used, don't even want to repeat his expressions, but he said, no more Washington, and he makes his capital in Des Moines, Iowa, whatever it is, right? He goes to somewhere, he goes to Vermont, or somewhere. Then that is a pretty big change. That is a sign, of course the people go crazy, the sign of ultimate control. That would be the leader who says, I'm in control, I can move the capital to wherever I want it to be. That's what Ahasuerus is doing. Fascinating. And he says, you know what? At the beginning of this whole story, what is happening is Ahasuerus is turning the limited kingship to an unlimited kingship. And you know why he's limited? Because he married the daughter, the granddaughter, we said this last week, of Nebuchadnezzar. He married into the right family. But the rabbis say, you know what Ahasuerus is called to fame? What did he do when he grew up? He was running a stable. He was good with the horses, right? He was a schlepper. And that's what he did. But you know, he saw that the Vashti, maybe she was young, and he helped her with the horse riding. You know, stories like, you get these stories from the Crown and from British monarchy, you hear stories like this. Downton Abbey had a story like that. Those of you who are into Downton Abbey, if you remember the Irish guy, he marries into the family. He was the chauffeur, right? You know, you get this kind of story from time to time. So basically what happened was that Ahasuerus married the right woman. Who did he marry? Vashti. He married the Yichus. But he's got a problem. His problem is, whenever he says, I want to do something, Vashti says, no, I'm the boss. Get out of here. Ahasuerus, realize your position. You want to come and do something which is crazy. You want to do something which is out of control. You're married. You're in your position because of me, says Vashti. So you know what Ahasuerus decided? I've got to change this. I've got to become an unlimited control. And if I'm unlimited control, I can do whatever I want. And the first thing I'm going to do, get rid of Vashti. That's got to be the first thing. Pretty desperate. Pretty amazing. And again, just turn over the page. Page 2. In fact, let's read this in the English because it sort of works. And it goes like this. And it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines. Where are we? 8 lines from the bottom of the page. I'll read it in the English. And we go through the psukim. We read them last week. The opener writes, the writer opens with, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is page 2 at the bottom of the page, about 8 lines from the bottom. It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, which is the verse that we start off with, he was the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, comes to tell us that Ahasuerus was not of royal stock. Right? The beginning, he wasn't the royalty. And he also did not come to power slowly as a king of a small kingdom until it was forgotten that he was a commoner and that after that he would grow slowly. In fact, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus when he was still a commoner. In other words, what it's basically saying is that Ahasuerus became the head, the person who was running the whole show in the beginning because of the fact that he worked his way up through the ranks. And then, in those days, he became the Ahasuerus to rule from India to Ethiopia. His conquest happened so quickly, And again, according to the Malbim, it was Ahasuerus who conquered all of those lands. According to what we said last week, it was done before Ahasuerus. He inherited it, right? Because it was done by Cyrus and beyond. But it doesn't matter. That's a kind of historical question mark. But he says what happened was that Ahasuerus conquered so quickly that nobody remembered on which province exactly been the king first. They only remembered he was a commoner who reigned now from Hodu to Kush. So he's got phenomenal empire. And in those days he reigned on 127 provinces, and there wasn't much time between him being a commoner and a king. Because what happened was the empire expanded. He was a good soldier. And this is something that we've already explained. It would, you know, sort of become part of the discussion. Go to the next page. This explains, page 3 at the top, why the present tense is used. People could not recollect what he used to control. It all happened so quickly. It was so quick that people only remember Ahasuerus, the commoner, now ruled over 127 provinces. So basically what happened was Ahasuerus starts off as being as low on the totem pole as you could ever imagine. And through a series of circumstances, he gets raised, elevated, and then he marries the Yichus, he marries Vashti. And all of a sudden, boom, he's elevated to the top of the tree. And it happens so quickly, and he's a good soldier, and we know that the Persian army was fit, was frightened, absolutely frightening. One of the things you gain from seeing the movies is how terrifying those armies were. And the reality of it was that Ahasuerus is moving quickly through the ranks. But now he has a problem. And his problem is he can only go so high, but he's still limited. He's limited by his marriage. So what's going to happen? He has to show that he is stronger than her. So he starts off with a party, not like we said last week, with people coming to raise an army, although that can be part of his show of strength. But he's just showing off his riches. He's showing off his wealth. He's showing off what he has. He's showing off the storehouse. All of this stuff, more and more and more. And you'll see what the question in the middle of the page is so interesting. On page 3, right in the middle, when he showed, we have already explained, a monarchy of limited power, the national wealth belongs to the nation, not to the king. He is not free to make himself great by displaying everything he's got, because he's limited, right? The Queen of England doesn't put it all on show. She has a ton of things, but you've got to work hard to actually try and get to see it. It's not always available. In order to rule with absolute power, Ahasuerus appropriated them and exhibited them before the assembled nation like a man who flaunts his own wealth. It's as if he's saying, "This is mine. This is all my stuff." Of course, it wasn't his, but he's beginning to create an impression of intense power. And it goes on, and he says this was a party of 180 days, and the whole thing with Vashti, which he explains at the bottom here, that he asked, the Malbim says in the third paragraph in Hebrew then, about two-thirds of the way down, Lama asta Vashti mishte b'yichud, v'karat b'shem mishte nashim. Why did Vashti make her party? Because she was trying to stop him. She was trying to stop Ahasuerus becoming so crazy and so full of his own importance and his own ability, and not realizing that she was the key to his greatness. Without her, he's nothing. So she makes her own party. And of course, Ahasuerus at that point has to make a decision. And the decision is very, very interesting. Says the Malbim. And if you open up the Chumashim that you have, and look at page 1252, and I'm just working on the first chapter, just to give you a little taster. I can't go through the whole Malbim, but give you a taster of what he's saying. It kind of ties in with what we've been saying, but he's more focused on the text. And it says like this, Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13, Vayomer ha-melech lachamim yudei itim. He's got to talk to advisors. If a king is limited to the advisors, that's a sign of limitation. He wants to be above them. So initially he's got to talk to the advisors. He came to Varamela, Lifnei Koy Dei Dat V'Din. This is normally the way the king functions. And we have all the list of the advisors. Go down to verse 15. Kedot malasot b'malkah Vashti. What do I do with Vashti? She refused to come in to the party. She refused to attend the banquet. He is now stressing that I want to be the ultimate melech. And she didn't come in. So who speaks up? Vayomer Mumuchan. Say the rabbis, you know who this is? Surprise, Mumuchan. Possibly, one suggestion, it's Haman. Haman is already putting in his little, sort of comments, working his way into the good books of the king. Some say it's Daniel, some say it's Haman. There's a whole discussion about that, but it's interesting. Pasuk, verse 16, so Haman says, in front of everybody, in other words, Vashti has not just sinned against you, O king. She's embarrassed everybody. Everyone has been, as it were, slighted by her behavior. You said she should come to the party. She refused. Remember, she wanted her to come in naked. She said, I'm not doing that. That's belittling. Basically, she was not having any of this. But what are you going to do? The husband's out of control. And he's got advisors. And they say, verse 17, Ki yetzei devar malka kol anashim. What's going to happen is that the women are going to get the initiative from Vashti and they're going to start abusing their husbands. And in Persian society, that's a no-no. Men are in control and women are subservient. That's the way it was in those days. They're worried. So what are we going to do instead? Let's go to 19. Verse 19, Imala Melech Tov, Yetzei Devar Malchut Nefanav, O King, issue a decree, V'yikatei B'datei Parasim Odai, V'lo Yavo, it becomes law in Persia, Asher Lo Tavo Vashti Levei Melech Ashvesh, because Vashti didn't appear when you called her, Malchut, and of course now it's not Vashti a Malka anymore, it's just Vashti without the Malka, verse 19, U'malchuta, so what's happened to her kingship? Yitain ha-melech liruta ha-tova mi-melech. That he'll have someone else. But once he's got rid of Vashti, you know what happens? He's totally in control. He's now got his hand on the steering wheel. He's got his hand on the brakes. Well, his foot on the brakes. He's got his hand on... He's driving the car. No one, there's no backseat driver, nothing. So interesting, yeah.
It seems like you're going to level of intentionality.
Yeah.
He doesn't need Shushan to see that he's in charge.
Yeah, he wants it. It's already starting in the first party. The call out was in the second party because I guess by he's established Shushan as the new capital, and by establishing himself as this incredibly powerful king, this is the moment he judged it to be the moment when he pushes her out of the whole situation. Sorry? You know what? The 127 countries may not care so much about his relationship with Vashti. But in Shushan, it's a big deal. Because Persia controls the whole mores, the whole morality of the kingdom. And by doing this in front of his home audience, you know, it's like a difference between home and away. When the home team wins, it's a big deal. When the home team is away and they win, okay, it's a big deal, but not such a big deal. You know, you win in front of your home ground, it's a big deal. I think that's what's going on here. He's chosen this moment because I think he sees this as the most opportune moment to get that message, not just of kicking out Vashti, but of him becoming the absolute controller. And you're right. He could have done it, I guess, earlier, but maybe you can argue, like Rav Lau says, he's busy with lots of other things going on. Right? Because he's raising an army. He's trying to get people together. If he was really wanting to get rid of Vashti, he could have done it earlier. And that's a question on the Malbim. Okay? The Malbim may go for that. I don't know.
Vashti confers legitimacy.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So when you want to demonstrate, and we talked about
the first party. Correct. Correct. Yeah.
Unless he felt he was secure,
because he's got all that support. I mean, there's a lot going on here. You know, I'm not on purpose not going through the whole. As I said, the moment is very long. We could spend like a month on this commentary. But I wanted to show you two things. Number one, how intricate the whole beginning of the story is, and this is the kicker. What the Malbim says at the end, He says, now that Ahasuerus has become so incredibly powerful, and the whole event revolves around a decree of the king, then without belief in Hashem, without emunah, without faith in God, the whole story just becomes so impossible to happen, because he issued a decree, kill the Jews. And he backs up Haman 100%. So without the whole concept of God's intervention, even behind the scenes, it's almost impossible to conceive of Ahasuerus not being able to carry through his decree, which he made on Haman's recommendation. And even more now, because he's become so powerful that he can make the decree, and almost, and you'll see the minister disappear. He can just snap his fingers and anything can happen. There's no longer even a council of wise men. By the end of chapter 1, he's done away with it, more or less. And that in itself is really incredible, right? You know, what's been the revelation? Ahasuerus is not an idiot. He really is not. He's a calculating, very dangerous individual who's got his own aspirations, not only of grandeur in the world of kings, but as I'm suggesting, almost to that, he's calling himself a god. He wants to make himself all-powerful, above and beyond anything that's come before him. And in the middle of all of this, the Jews are mixed in. And it's very amazing what happens, you know, Nahapoch, the beginning to see the concept of turnaround. Things are turning around in the palace in chapter 1, and the whole Megillah is going to be about turnaround. Everything what you thought was black is white, everything you thought that's white is black. You know, the whole thing is just incredible. So your point is interesting, and I'm glad you're thinking it through, because, you know, you've got to play around with these ideas. I'm not saying this is the only way to look at chapter 1, but it's so interesting. Right? And where did he get all this political science knowledge from? Amazing.
Did Vashti have still some support?
I suspect she had family support, right? You know, I mean, she's got all the bobbers and zaders, you know, she's got the whole connection. But you know what? It's a male-oriented society. The whole thing runs by the men. And Persia, wow. You know what becomes interesting? I think that Vilna Gaon points out that the whole thing of chapter 1 is to show that the king is so powerful that when it comes to changing the decree, he's made a decree to kill the Jews. And the decree in Persia is 100%. You know, you've got to be Superman to be able to change it. And if he would have had the situation of a limited kingship, to change the decree, he's got to call a cabinet meeting and you've got to have this and that. It would never have happened. And then, lo and behold, it would have been a terrible end. So the fact that he's become so powerful allows him in the end, when the decree has to be changed, he can do it. And that in itself is very, very interesting. So you see what's going on in chapter 1. It's kind of setting the groundwork for everything that's going to come. The principle of Nahapoch, the strength of Ahasuerus, the ability to become unlimited control. And at the same time, when he needs to step in, not willingly, I suspect, but he does it, he changes the whole dynamic of the story by reversing the decree. Incredible. Yeah. Yeah, to show that this is, I'm, you know, this is my party, this is not your party. And by the time you get to the end of the story here, as we just read, the word Malka of Vashti disappears completely. What are we going to do with Vashti? Not even Vashti or Malka anymore. Because that was his plan. He wants to diminish her. Initially she says, how dare you? And by the time we're finished, she's history. She's gone.
Exiled, or is she killed?
She's killed. And he, who knows what charges he made, you know, disobedient. I mean, a million and one things that they could have done. As I said, you know, when I read this Malbim, I had to bring it to your attention. Because it just so, again, as Rav Lau is so based in the history, this is based in a sort of combination. He doesn't teach us anything about Persian history, the Malbim, except kind of general morality of the society, which is not really anything to write home about. But the reality of it is that he does, I think he complements in a way what we've been learning till now, explaining Ahasuerus' character even to be more devious and out of control than we considered it beforehand. It's just very, very fascinating. I just want to show you, because we're going to run out of time, we've got one more thing to do. Just go on to page 4. The last thing, and I just want to read a few lines of his end of the Malbim's commentary on chapter 1. He says, Ulam, it's the second paragraph on page 4. And again, not going to read the whole thing, just a few lines. He says, Ma'ashik dima pasha zot le sipur megillah. Now I'm going to say, why do we have this whole introduction of chapter 1? Minit chayavnu likro the Korah b'purim ke'ilu hi shaykh le sipur anes. And we have to read it on Purim. It's part of the Megillah. If you don't read chapter 1, you're not yotzei in the Megillah on Purim. He says, Echshov bo shnei tamim. I'm going to give you two reasons. One, for hu atami kriyatzli. This is the main reason. Ki klala sipur azed, the story of chapter 1, it's really the foundation for everything that comes afterwards. Because if the king had not made the effort to become unlimited in his control, he could never have taken Esther in because the people would have complained. The people said, you know, what are you doing, king? You're marrying this girl, you don't know where she comes from, you don't know who she is, you're out of your mind. He would not tolerate any of that dissent because he's 100% in control. Ki lo hayu sarei ha'etza maskimim. His advisors would never have agreed for him to marry Esther. She kapsu lemelech na'arob betulot, to bring all these girls, levro mehem isha, to choose a wife. That would never have been agreed to. V'yav ki lekachat isha asher leyoda amam. And not only that, but he doesn't know where she's from and doesn't know where she's born. And you know, you're taking a complete commoner. And that would have not happened. V'lo hakdala Haman, and even to make Haman elevated as he did, shaloya yachol lasod ze b'li reshut ha'sarim, he would have had to call a cabinet meeting. That's not happening anymore because he's totally in control, Achashverosh. And when he says, kill all the Jews, and we know Achashverosh did not like the Jews, right? There's no ambivalence about that. All of that is because he is absolute controller. That's what the rabbis say. If it wasn't for the first letters that we just read about, all of these letters going backwards and forwards about the status of men and women in the society, then we could never have had the whole story later on with the letters to announce to kill the Jews and then afterwards to annul that particular announcement. And he goes on like this, and again, I just have to leave you with this because it is so beautiful. It is so precious the way, again, he looks a very, very dynamic and very different approach. We've seen two approaches, essentially, to chapter 1. Both of them really on the same lines of seeing Achashverosh as this larger-than-life, but very, very powerful, super powerful person, who, in the way that he deals with his kingdom, has a mission, as it were, right, to become the most powerful leader in the world. And all of this slots in to that aspiration that he has, to that ambition, and this is an ambitious man. His extreme ambition. And again, what we see by the end of chapter 1, just go back to page 1253, just to see what happened to Vashti, to just confirm, we're looking at verse 20. V'nishma pitgam ha-melech b'chol she'yaseh b'chol malchuto, ki rabah hi, what the king says is now absolute. V'chol ha-nashim yinu yikar le-baliheim, all the women have to give honor to their husbands, v'gadol v'katan, whether large or small, great or little, v'yitav ha-davar b'nei ha-melech, v'asarim, at this point everybody is happy, v'yas ha-melech k'davar mochan, the king listens to mochan, v'yishlas v'arim ha-kom b'nei ha-melech, etc., etc., niyot kolish soreh b'beito, u'medaber k'lashon amo. And that's the end of chapter 1. The scene is set. And when you get chapter 2, the first verse, achar ha-davarim ha-elech, which I always understood as being, okay, next, what happened after that? But now that we've seen the way Rav Lau has put the historical perspective, we're talking about 7 years later. We're talking about, we had 7 years into her kingship, 4 years later. Remember, the party was third year of his kingship, and chapter 2 is the seventh year of his kingship, so there's a 4 year gap. This little break between chapter 1 and chapter 2 is really significant. Because what happens between chapter 1 and chapter 2 are the wars of Persia, right? The wars that he had, the Thermopylae, which was a, even though the Persians won, it was a complete busha to them. It was a disgrace what happened to them. They couldn't overcome the 300. And then you have the war in 480 of Salamis, where the Persian army, the Persian navy essentially was destroyed. And by the time you get to chapter 2, you're getting to the year 479. And in 479, Ahasuerus is returning. Xerxes coming back to Shushan. His wife is dead, right? So he needs someone to comfort him, because basically the poor guy is, as you say, he's a bit tsefloigen, you know, he's really in trouble. He's really got nothing to comfort him at home. His kingdom is in upheaval because he's lost. All his army, more or less, is gone. Everything around him has fallen apart. So what does he do? Look at the beginning of chapter 2. And this is where I wanted to get into today. And again, middle of page 1253. After these things, after he calmed down. Now it doesn't say, we always assume calming down because of Vashti. But it could also be that his anger and his disappointment was beginning to calm down because of everything that's happened to him. Could be the loss of all the battles also made him incredibly angry. Right? It doesn't say what the Chamat HaMelech was about. He calms down a bit. Then Zocharet Vashti v'tasher asata, he starts thinking about his wife that's no longer with him, v'et kol asher nigzar aleha, and everything that was done to her, that she was killed. And then v'yomru na'amei HaMelech, is no longer his sarim, it's not his officers anymore, it's a couple of lads around the palace, you know, courtiers. Na'arei HaMelech m'sharetav, yivakshu l'melech na'aro betulot tovot mareh. King, you need another wife. You need a woman that can comfort you. Go and choose all the betulot, all the virgins from around the empire. V'yafked ha-melech pekidim b'chol midah. He's not taking advice anymore. He is calling in all of these women. He's appointing officers to go. V'yikbetzu et kol na'ara betulah tovat mareh. What's the requirement to be called in? You've got to look nice, right? According to their definition of beauty. El Shushana Biral Beta Nashim, bring them to the harem. Ali de Hege Sarissa Melech Shamer Nashim. This guy Hege gets a big mention over here. But Natan Tamrukiyah, and this is really where they're at, put on their makeup and the whole story. And Vanara Shetita Beneha Melech, Timloch Tachav Vashti, Beitava Dava Beneha Melech. Nobody else? There's no officers here to discuss it with. Vayaske, and he does, on their advice, calls people in. Unbelievable. And what we're going to say is like this, and this is where we got into the whole discussion last week, and again, I just want to show you this page. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing, I'm just going to praise it, but I want you to have it, a copy of it. Because it is really quite shocking. The whole question of who was, who were these people, Ahasuerus, who was Mordechai and who was Esther. Probably of all the things that we're going to be learning, this is the most disturbing. We've got the elections going on, right, for the new wife. And all of a sudden we see Mordechai comes in verse 6, the next verse, verse 5, Ish Yudi, Ayab Shushan Abira, Shmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ish Yemini. Okay, and we're introduced to Mordechai. And we always have this kind of mental image, as I've said last week, I'm just going to go through this again, of who Mordechai is. He's the quintessential Jewish leader. Esther is the quintessential Jewish girl, you know, who's taken into the palace by force, etc., seemingly not willingly, you know, all the sort of limud that we've had till now. Rav Lau says, yes, I accept the rabbinic definition of what we're doing here. But, he says, I've got to give you a counterpoint. And this is the page that I've given you over here. Number one, we spoke about last week, point number one on the page I gave you. And that is their names. They've got very unkosher names. He points out Mordechai is Marduk. He says on the sixth line of paragraph one, Shemol Shorosh HaPantheon Shel Elim B'Bavel. The biggest god of all of the pantheons in Bavel, whatever gods they had in Babylon. Zeu Shem Shemavtiach Shilum Shel Elim B'Bavel Im Elohei HaAretz. It's a god that linked the gods of Babylon with all the gods, all small g, all the gods of the whole world. Right? So that is a pretty unholy name, Mordechai. Who knew? And then he says, Esther, he Estahar, Istar, Ishtar, Ha'ela, or Eloah, Ha'meira, et Shemei Paras. The moon, Astarte, she was the god of, named after the god of the moon. Bechad Eloi, right? Be'or Eloi, with a godly light, but with again, with a small g. Im Shemot Ke'ela, that with names like this, and we know Esther had a good Jewish name, Hadassah. Yesh Sikui, there is a chance, he says, Lishtalev Ba'aretz Hizdamnuyot Hadasha, the land of opportunity. His suggestion is absolutely shocking. He says Mordechai and Esther at the beginning were part of an assimilative community. What does that mean? It means that in order to get on in the world, go back in America 80, 90 years, the first thing you do when you come to America, remember the film Hester Street? Do you remember that film in Yiddish? Very wonderful film. And what did it highlight? It highlighted the fact that Yankele came to America and he became Jake. But Nebuch, he's got Rochelea coming over from the Haim, and she's not going to become whatever, you know, sort of Rosemary. She's never going to take on a non-Jewish name. And of course, it gets eventually to a situation of divorce. I remember there's a very powerful scene with a divorce going on in that story. It's unreal. And that is a typical, unfortunately, what happened in the early days, people coming from Europe to the United States, when they came to England. Apparently, my grandfather got off the boat in London in 1895 and thought it was New York. This is what I was told. He thought it was New York. So he ended up living his whole life in London instead of living in New York. Go figure. I don't know. People just, they couldn't, I don't know how that happened. I'm really not sure. But, you know, it was beshared in the end. The very, very interesting. His suggestion is that Mordechai and Esther are leaders of a very assimilated Jewish community. So you know what? The king puts an announcement in Craigslist, or whatever they had in those days. It's online, Facebook, of the Persian Empire. Wanted one new queen. I need a new queen. Right? Almost to the point where he doesn't even care where she's coming from, who she is, doesn't want to know her people, her birth, just needs a queen. So Mordechai is there. And what is Mordechai doing? Where is he? He's Yoshei Bashar HaMelech. So we always thought, he's got a little benkel over there, he's got a little chair, just by the way you come in, you know, sort of at the doorway of the palace. What is he doing there? Look at paragraph 2. Ma'amado ha'ishi shel Mordechai, ha'yoshev b'shar ha'melech, when he's sitting at the palace of the king, melamed aliyoto totsar l'anhaga mekomit. He's a leader, he's a lay leader, who has done very well in Persian society, because he's sitting literally in the lap of the king. Lelo shei u'tsheirid l'motza'o yudi. Not really worried about his Jewishness, because that in a way would hinder him. If they all knew he was Jewish, he wouldn't get a job, right? And this is, we know this from modern history. It was very difficult at one time to get a job. Nowadays, thank God, we're living in a much better place, certainly here and in many places in Europe. But being Jewish is not a hindrance anymore. But once upon a time, it really was. He says, E'efshar ledamyein ish yudi yoshei b'shar hamelech, in other words, to think that he's a Rosh Yeshiva with a longer record, long coat, and a black hat, and he's sitting there amongst all the people in Persia, no way. He said they just would not tolerate that sort of image in the palace. So to gain his position, he's got to go to school. He's got to go to night school, wherever it is. To become one of the leaders. He learns civics. He learns all the political science that he needs to know. He's trying to go up the ladder in the social world that he's living in. Hamidrash mata'ed Mordechai ke'echad me'asarim kvar b'shlav ha'mukdam. The Midrash says he was an officer. He was right up there at the beginning. Hazeh shel Megillah, the beginning of the Megillah. Rak ma'amad zeh marsheh lo talich. So he says, sitting at the palace of the king is not a good Jewish man sitting there, it's an assimilated Jew. It's a Jew who wants to raise himself up the ladder of success. Esther is going to be even more of a shock. Yes. That's a good question. And one feels possibly... Yes, I tell you what's in the back of my mind. There's a whole Gemara when Esther goes to the rabbis. She says, I want you to write down the story of the Megillah. And you know what they said? Absolutely not. And there's no explanation, so you wonder what's going on there. Eventually they agree, right? She says, otherwise it'll be lost, but they make an excuse, it'll increase anti-Semitism, whatever they say. But you get that impression that their feeling about Mordechai and Esther, as great as they were, was there was a certain amount of distance. Because you know what? These people, in the way that they conducted themselves, the society where they come from, they were part of the Persian elite. Mordechai was sitting there. Esther, we're going to say, wanted to jump on the bandwagon. How do you jump on the bandwagon? By becoming the princess, the new princess of Persia, the new queen. How do you do that? By marrying Ahasuerus. But you're Jewish. Don't tell him who you are. Mordechai says, don't tell him who you are. Don't tell him that you're Jewish. Don't tell him where you come from. And you know what? With a bit of luck, he may choose you. Right? You're eligible enough. And with, I can finagle this and finagle that. And of course, you get the whole plot. And Mordechai is listening and he has the word. And he goes to the king and he tells the king what's going on. So Mordechai is very well connected. Is he the great quintessential Jewish leader at this point in time? Chapter 2? No. Is Esther the great quintessential Jewish, the young girl that's going to sort of change the world in favor of the way that we normally would have seen Esther? The answer is, at this moment in time, no. They become that. Yeah. Oh, that's next week's shit.
Implies that he's not.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He's
just not on the inside. Yeah. Yeah. And that's next week's shit, because Jerusalem is only mentioned once in the whole Megillah. And Rav Lau's argument, and I really adopt this, is that they've rejected the return to Yerushalayim. So Mordechai is in fact introduced as having come from a line of people that came from Yerushalayim, with the implication of, but he's not going back now. He's Yoshev Bashar Malik. He's sitting in the palace of the king. He's not going back to Yerushalayim. What for? He's done so well in the diaspora. He doesn't need to go back. And not only that, but he's now trying to find a position for Esther to become also elevated. It's shocking. I'm always scared to say this because it just, as I said, shatters so many illusions that one had about these people. But I said in the first week, and I maintain it, it makes the story so much more powerful when they decide, you know what, we've got to do something about what's going on. And we're not necessarily the most religious and well-connected Jews in the world, but we're Jewish, and we need to stand up. And there's so many people, thank God, in the world today, just with all the anti-Semitism that's going on. And people are standing up and making statements and saying this is unacceptable. And that. And there are Jews who are really stepping up to the plate, who may not necessarily come to shul more than once a year, if that, but they are there making those pronouncements. And that's really what we're dealing with here. It's shot up.
History is repeating itself.
Sorry?
History
always repeats itself. The problem is, do we learn from history? That's really the challenge. There's repetition a lot, but do we learn from it? Do Jews learn from history? Oh, wow. I heard Dennis Prager, a very wonderful presenter, give a talk about this.
What we see here in this book of Esther is what the Jews did was orchestrate the downfall of a principal anti-Semite.
Yeah, but in a way which we have to explain, there's a lot more to get to, obviously.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is, we'll get there. But the point is how the story develops in terms of the Jewish leadership, where we thought this was really leadership of a very high spiritual level, and it turns out, nothing of the sort. They do become, but he's Marduk, and she's this Stahar. And they're a nice, sort of assimilated Jewish family. Not even, and Jewish with a small J that you can't even see the J, right? It's in brackets and it's sort of hidden in the small print. And this is who they are. Do they become Jews with a capital J? Yes. But that will come later. Rav Lau is going to suggest, by the way, that the whole change, the moment of change in the Megillah is not when we usually say that the king woke up and he couldn't sleep, and he had a bad night. He says the change actually comes in chapter 4, two chapters earlier. And that's Mitzvah Shem, what we're going to see next week. Please go to next week or two. Right? We're working our way through this because it demands attention. But what an interesting story. Just going to finish with, I'll just take one question and then I'm going to finish the final comment over here.
This is a very old expression.
Yes. They remind you. Yeah, and that happens. Boy. Oy, oy, oy. Listen to this. Look at number four. And this is where I fear to tell you this, but I've told you this. Knisatah shel Esther de Beit HaNashim. We just saw Esther was taken to the harem. He chelek mimamad ha'isha. That's the status symbol. Mamlechet Achashverosh in the kingdom of Xerxes. Betoch olam shel gevarim. In a manly world. Haisha ina yoter mitzatzu amini. What is the woman? She's a toy, a sexual toy. Miutar lomar shezui chelek meha tachposet. She'll kotev Megillah. It's part of the hidden, you know, the dressing up, as it were, of the Megillah, he says. Hamatziget olam ha-gvarim hazeh b'malo chushato. Because the writer of the Megillah is expressing the whole of what's going on with all the weaknesses of that world, the Persian world. At the end of the day, who really changes the world? Women. So it's an irony going on here. Who's going to become so powerful to change all the perceptions in the story? It's going to be Esther. Etc. Vashti, started off with Vashti, ad the sofar till Esther. Now he says, b'toch hatzaga hazu, in this presentation, Esther masacheket et tafkid ha-mishni. She's at the moment secondary to Mordechai. Shel ha'alma yafa, she's a beautiful girl. Shtikata yafa la, who doesn't say a word. Kashehi tiftach et pia, lifnei ha'melech, but once she does speak to the king, he kava tiye ishiyut acheret. She's a different person, as we'll find out when we read chapters 3 and 4. And, b'shlav zehi ha'nara parsit, she's a Persian girl. Here comes the shocker. Shemavakeshet lenetzach lenatzeh. She wants to win. But tacharuta yofi shanarot shushan. The beauty contest of Shushan. That's all she's there for, to win the contest. Because he puts her in a higher social position. So at this point in time, this is where I'm holding it for today. We've arrived, we've seen chapter 1. We've looked at it from both a very big external picture and a more internal picture. We've now got to chapter 2, the beginnings of the emergence of Mordechai and Esther. But the shock at the beginning, I think, is to realize that they're not who you think they are. And we're going to see Mirat Hashem as we go through chapter 2, and particularly when we start dealing with Haman later on, a whole awareness of the relationship between Mordechai and Haman, which again is not what you think it was. Is Haman starting off as the quintessential anti-Semite? That's something we'll have to make a judgment. I know we all think he is, and we all, you know, bang Haman, and we all sort of do all that stuff, but when he started off, it may have been much more personal. That, again, is a big shock to the system. Mirat Hashem next week, all I'm going to ask you to think about is this beginning, if when you start reading the Megillah, if you start reading through chapters 1 through, let's say 1 through 5, where the word Balka appears. Sometimes it's appearing with Vashti, for instance, we saw the word Malka is dropped. And with Esther, we're going to see that the word Malka all of a sudden appears out of nowhere, chapter 5. And we have to ask ourselves the question, what is really happening with the use of this word Malka? I heard wonderful, wonderful shiurim. There's a great lecture in Bar Ilan called Meir Svi Gruzman, a wonderful man, must be well into his 80s by now. And he wrote a whole paper on this, and it's brilliant. So Bezrat Hashem, won't get to it maybe next week, but in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll get an analysis of the word Malka, and really again, opening up so much of the Megillah, which we didn't realize what it was about. I leave you to ponder on this. I hope it doesn't spoil your week, or your Purim. At the end of the day, it's a fantastic story, but what an interesting story. And the Malbim, what a political science major he would have been. Wow, something really expensive. Did he sit in Parliament? I don't think he did. Rav Hirsch sat in the German Parliament. Rav Meir Shapira sat in the Polish Parliament. Great rabbis. Did the Malbim sit in any Parliament? I don't think. I think it would have been too controversial. I think they would have thrown him out. They would have got rid of him because he really did not, you know, he said what he thought. But I'm glad that that shed a bit of light. To be continued, Bezrat Hashem, next week. Look forward. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.